Hello and welcome. I'm Dennis Prout, Certified Financial Planner.
And I'm Shay Pataja, the co-host of
New Retirement Radio,
the podcast.
Investment advisory services offered through Capital Asset Advisory Services, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Genios Wealth Management Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Capital Asset Advisory Services. The topics discussed and the opinions given are for informational purposes only and are not intended as financial, tax, accounting, or legal advice, and are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their individual needs with an appropriate professional.
By WTCM News Talk 580, 11 after the hour, time for New Retirement Radio with Prout Financial Design. Joining us today, Mr. Prout, Dennis Prout.
It's great to be here. Good morning, all. On 331, the LOL. Last day of March. And Shay joins us as well. Our CXP, our CXO.
We just make up titles around here. I did make it into work today, despite the weather. I just got outside and I was like, ew.
Yeah, it's kind of slimy, slushy, smushy out there.
Yeah,
I'm sure it won't be on Saturday, so don't take too long and don't dawdle on the weather that, Dennis. Hurry it up there, old boy.
Oh, really?
Wow, what's going on with it? You know, just, I think that the weather has got me all wound about, and this chair is ultra squeaky.
Oh, boy. Well, maybe,
it is squeaky.
You want to?
I'm just going to stand
up. Do you want to try the other one there? Let me turn the mic down while Dennis switches the chairs.
He's drinking a mocha from Morsels.
I hope
and
that one's
got him
okay.
All wired.
Uh-oh.
And Heidi's not here to keep us in
funny,
line.
No kidding.
Yeah, Heidi.
She would not allow this to happen. Obviously,
no
everyone
way.
Can tell that Heidi is not here.
Kim's outside with a can of WD-40.
No, you're not the first one to complain.
We need it, believe me. That dude is loud. He's a noisy man. Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for listening. Today we have John Sluice, CPA with Intrust CPAs.
That's what messed me up. I said CFA. It's a CFP with a CPA here.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
See, there was something going on there. I just knew it. But anyway, it's great to have John joining us this morning. CPA.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just
good morning,
having
John.
To think.
Good morning.
CPA. Well, Intrust CPAs, you're local here in town. Your phone number for anyone who might have a question after the show, 231-935-1590. Thank you, John, for calling in. We certainly appreciate it. How are you this morning?
I'm good. I'm probably the only person that likes the weather outside in town right now because, you know, as a CPA, we just get to look outside. And so we're entirely okay with it being that nice out there because if we can't be out there, you know what? Now, come April 18th, it better be sunny out. So,
yes.
But yeah.
We're at the end of tax filing season. So you just gave information out voluntarily without anyone really asking. The final tax day this year is April 18th.
April 18th, and it's throwing a lot of people off on that because the 15th is actually a Friday, and so people assume it's the 15th. But actually what it is Washington, D.C. celebrates Emancipation Day, which is a holiday there for them. And so the IRS is technically closed on the 15th, and so we get till the 18th.
All right. So. Awesome. So the 10 red flags that could trigger an IRS audit, we're going to discuss the three big ones you specifically mentioned that you see in your practice, are ongoing issues for folks. Obviously, we're talking about 2021 filing of taxes. The first issue you mentioned that you thought was the big one of the IRS red flags was virtual currency. Yeah. Virtual currency. What's going on with that? Okay. You made some great illustrations about that in our meeting about this show.
Yeah, and we've talked about this in the past, but the virtual currency, and again, not getting into whether it's good, bad, or otherwise, it's just the idea of whether you have virtual currency. And what makes it a red flag is it's right on the tax return, is it's have you done, had bought, sold, purchased, or held virtual currency, yes or no? And so it's a yes, no question right on there. And what they're trying to get to is they don't know. That's what makes it a red flag, and that's what makes it scary. Because it's actually, when you get involved into it, it's very similar and it's treated like a stock. And so the best way I can describe this is imagine that you, everyone listening that has financial advisors, and you don't get a statement at the end of the year for your brokerage account. And you had to come up with everything that happened inside of there. So you had to come up with the basis schedules and whether it's a short-term gain or a long-term gain or whether there was any stock splits or buybacks or whether some of the income that you got was interest or dividends or capital gains and what about capital gain distributions. All of those things, if you had to come up with it and you didn't rely on the financial brokerage firm to give that to you, that's kind of what cryptocurrency is like right now and why it's more of a red flag. It's not in and of itself that's the cryptocurrency that's the red flag. It's the fact that it's not reported in many of the agencies that the companies that actually you utilize the cryptocurrency on don't give you that information. And so it's up to you as the holder of the cryptocurrency to track all of that. And the IRS knows that, and they know that people don't necessarily track it. And so that's what makes it a red flag. So just having it's not a bad thing. But what it is that the IRS knows that there's a lot that's out there. And so if you do check, yes, you just have to make sure that you do it properly. That's the key.
You track it properly and account for any tax consequence from it, right, from the ownership.
Correct. And the big surprise for most people is that cryptocurrency is treated like a stock. It's not a currency. So people think cryptocurrency, currency. So like if you go to the store and you transfer a dollar for that pack of gum, to you, it's not a taxable transaction that you're, you know, keeping the basis of your dollar and you're not keeping the basis of the gum that you just purchased.
Because now, it's a currency.
Because it's a currency. Well, cryptocurrency is actually not, it's not a currency to the IRS. It's property. And so that, if you use cryptocurrency as a transactional type basis or item, every one of those transactions becomes a taxable event. And it starts generating thousands and thousands and thousands of potential transactions in taxable items.
Wow, so all that Bitcoin you were going to buy, Ron, I'm sure you're having second thoughts now.
I got scared away. I just didn't want to be audited.
It just doesn't sound like any fun. So every time I liquidate some Bitcoin to buy a bag of potato chips, I've got to report that possible gain or loss to the IRS.
Correct. Yep. And it, again, think of it like a stock. So if you have someone that's, as a stock individual, if you're buying and selling and churning your stocks every single day, your statement would be, you know, volumes long. Same idea, same concept. So if you buy it as an investment and hold it, that's not that hard. You know, if you bought a Bitcoin and, you know, 10 years ago and now you're going to sell it, great. That's not complicated and not a red flag. The red flag is the lots and lots of transactions.
Too much activity. All right.
Yeah.
Number two, child tax credit among divorced couples. What does that mean?
Well, so what's happening here with, especially it's been light in light of all these the advanced child tax credit payments that came out this year. We've talked about this in the past as well, where if that's just an advance on a credit that you get at the end of the year. Well, now what happens is what happens if you're divorced and your divorce decree says that you have the child on an even year versus an odd year? Well, you got the advance payment based on the 2020 tax return versus the 21 year return. What happens then? There's lots of different scenarios that come into play there with the dependents, and I'll use dependents as the word here for it, because it's more than just children. But the dependents have become such an integral part of the tax returns for many people. I mean, I added it up this morning just in preparation here that one dependent could potentially be as much as $9,400 of credits, potentially. So who gets to claim that dependent has a big impact on people's tax returns. And so making sure you do it properly is key. And here's the key part of it, is that the IRS does not necessarily agree with what you think it might be. Like if you have a divorce decree and every other, that doesn't really make a difference. It makes a difference of who has the right to claim them as a dependent. And so what the red flag on this is, if you have two people both trying to claim the dependent, that's a no-go. You can't do that. So
Can't they just split it?
Cannot split it. It's very, very tricky, and they even make tax preparers now have to sign off that we've had the discussions with, and we have to document now why, because it comes down to who has the right to claim the dependent, and that right isn't always necessarily just the divorce decree. It may be, it more often it leads towards, it's the custodial this custodial parent that is the one that claims them. And so whether if they're living with someone for more than 50% of the time, even if the divorce decree says something different, that information is conflicting, and the IRS has one thing and the divorce decree may have another one.
All right.
No, you can't just split.
So you got to pay attention to the IRS rules as well as what the divorce decree says.
So hey, I have a question, John. That child tax credit used to be you claimed it on your taxes, and then they chopped that down from what you might owe on your tax bill, and good chance you would get a check from the IRS. Now they're just sending out every month $300 or whatever it might be per dependent. What if you have 50-50 custody? It's still only one of those parents gets that that monthly check?
You're hitting the topic right on the head there. That's exactly what we're talking about. Is that the answer to that is no, you do not get both. It's one or the other.
Wow.
And it's different. And so that's what becomes the messy part of it. And then the he said, she said type things that come into play there. So, yeah.
Wow.
And you also mentioned something in there, too, of what we are seeing a lot is for people that didn't realize that that advance payment that's coming in is just an advance payment. It's not free money. It's not new money. It's just a payment on what you otherwise would have gotten in your refund. And so many people's refunds now are less than what they have been in the past because they got it during the year. And it did exactly what the IRS and the Treasury wanted it to do, which is instead of getting a big lump sum here at the end of the year, it came through on a dribbled through on a monthly basis, and people spent it, and it stimulated the economy. That's why they did what they did. Hmm. And so now the ramifications now is most individuals' refunds are less than what they otherwise would have been. So just a warning there. So
yes, no kidding.
Also note that's not going forward. That was just a July through December of last year. As of right now, that is not in place for people. Did not get payments in July or January and February and March.
Okay.
So that was just a one-time thing. So
okay, so for those who are thinking of having 15 children, they may want to rethink that strategy.
Yeah, it's not generally. I mean, I always tell people children is fantastic tax time, but it's just the one time of the year. The other 364 days go the other direction. So and generally, the 364 days way outweighs the one.
Sounds like the voice of experience there.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, John. Number three, understanding ratios for business expenses. What, you know, if we have a cash business, so the IRS might actually know about how much I'm spending on certain things. Is that what that could mean?
That is. You know, this is the age-old one. This is nothing particularly new here. But when you file your tax return, there's two things inside of the return that are, you know, to watch for here and to know, I guess, if you will. One is, we always tell our clients, you don't get to file the electronically. You have to file electronically. And because of that, the IRS has the ability to immediately do ratio analysis on your return because they have gigantic algorithms back in their system based on every single line item that gets put in. And so if you have certain items on one line versus another line, they know that and they can do immediate ratio analysis when you submit your tax return. And it's done very, very quickly now.
Wow.
And then also within that, on your Schedule C or in your business, there's a code that you put on there, so the SIC code or SIC code, that tells what type of business it is. And those ratios change depending on that business. So, for example, an attorney's office or a professional service versus office has different expenses than, say, a heavy equipment contractor. And so they know those ratios and they know those averages overall. And so if you put in that you're a professional service firm and you have $400,000 worth of equipment purchases, probably a red flag, whereas not a red flag for a heavy equipment contractor that bought that much of equipment, because that's normal for that industry. And they can see that and they look at that. So,
all right. So they got the background that they've used over thousands of people and as well as businesses. And they're able to tell, you know, what the audit triggers might be and or when they might question an expense. You gave this much to charity as an example, perhaps? Yeah.
Yeah. And well, one example that I want to kind of allude to that was on the email blast here, talking about how it may not necessarily be a bad thing, is let's do charitable contributions. So charitable contributions has a ratio of what the average American spends given a certain threshold. So if someone is making or makes $40,000, they kind of expect a range of what most average Americans that make $40,000 would contribute as compared to someone that's 100 or as compared to someone that's $400,000. And so they kind of mirror that, knowing that someone that's making $400,000 has the ability to put more in contributions than someone that's less. So they can do that. But here where I might point out, you might be a charitably inclined individual, and so your ratio is higher than normal. So just because you're out of ratio doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It just means it's a thing. So you just better be careful that, okay, if you're higher than normal, that you make sure you have your documentation in place and that you know it's okay. And that way, if it is questioned, you can say, yep, here's why, here's my information. And then it just, that answers the question.
Here's my receipts of all the dollars that I gave for 2021 from the variety of charities that I gave to.
You also said, and when we were talking, that it's not necessarily a bad thing if the IRS audits you, and I've never heard a CPA say that, John. You live on the
well,
edge, so let's hear it.
I want to be careful and clear on that. So we don't like audits. We don't want an audit. But the point on this is that is a little bit of the play into, one was the charity, that I'd love for people to be overly charitable and have that ratio and get, you know, a letter saying you contributed too much, and we get to very smiley, give them back and say, here's my receipts. So wouldn't that be fun if we could do that one?
Mm-hmm.
But more specifically, though, is that it's the idea of what is an audit now. So the definition of audit has changed significantly over the last couple years because of this ability for them to do these ratio analysis. So many of the audits, and I'll put audits in quotes now, are happening, are not what's called a desk audit, where you have a real live person. In fact, that's gone way down. Most of what the audits are now are automatic computer-generated responses that they say, hey, this ratio is out of whack. Please send information. So you get a letter, you send the information, you send it back. That's not a bad thing. It's just a thing. And so there's where I want to kind of tell people that it's okay that if you feel comfortable with what you've done, you've got your documents in place, that if you get a letter, it's not a bad thing. You just respond, and then you send it back.
I can bet it is the first letter that you open, given the mailbox.
Mm-hmm. It is. People see the IRS, and it's very scary. And that's where I'm trying to put that misnomer out there, that you got to treat it very seriously, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just something that you've got to respond.
So do you have to justify it? I mean, if you're a law firm, do you say, so we bought a bulldozer, big deal? None of your business.
Yep. You just have to explain why that would be legitimate for, if you happen to be, the attorney for a mob and you need a bulldozer for some reason, then okay,
right. There you go.
Exactly, right?
It has to have a legitimate business purpose for you there, Ron. That's what's going on, right?
Yes.
Indeed.
Great point. I mean, specifically also within those auto responses, what we're seeing here is that, again, it's the computer doing it. It's not a real-life person. And as you can imagine, those computers are perfect in everything that they do, right? Wrong. So they might say, hey, we expected to see this income on line 12. And you look at it like, well, no, we actually included it on line 14 because it related to something else. And so you just respond back and you say, hey, this is where it's at. And so they're doing these auto expectations that are there. And you just have to respond back and say, hey, here's what really happened. So it's just letting people know that those letters are out there. And it's happening a lot right now because the IRS is so understaffed. I mean, we're starting to see notices from people that have responded back from things from 2019 that they're just starting to generate and get through and process. Well, as you can imagine, if the response happened in 2019 and that happened right away back in 2019, and it's sitting there, there's auto-generated things that roll forward as a result of that that have not been addressed to either. And so it has a ripple effect. So we're just trying to tell people that it's not something you want to have, but it's not going to, be a horrible thing either.
So. Yeah, so just respond in kind with the appropriate information, and in most cases, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's great to have you, John, but let's listen together, shall we? The Shea Stats here this afternoon, this morning, wherever we are,
Yes. Well, I thought it'd be fun if you read the first one about stocks, because then you grabbed some other... You're better explaining all this.
Sure,
so.
I'll read this one.
Okay.
The U.S. stock market, including 4,266 public traded companies on the New York Stock Exchange, AMEX, and NASDAQ, was worth $53.4 trillion as of 12/31 of 21.
Hmm.
Amazing. So just about double or so our current deficit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we looked up what's the
current government debt, I should say.
The total amount of money saved in retirement accounts.
Yes. That number, we looked it up, but Shea had asked that, of $37 trillion. $37 trillion in retirement accounts, which includes IRAs, Roths, 401ks, all the rest.
So of the $53.4 trillion,
no,
this is in addition
this
to.
This is just an addition.
A separate number, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so obviously some of those stocks that are held through mutual funds and through trusts and all the rest are in retirement accounts. Some retirement accounts have bonds. Some retirement accounts have annuities, whatever it might be. Other assets. Some IRAs have cryptocurrency.
It's just kind of fun to look at the numbers side by side.
Yeah, the red flag just went up in here.
A little red flag.
Yeah. Don't say that word.
All right, U.S. grocery prices, so food at home, increased 8.6% over the year ending February 28th of 2022. That compares to a 3.5% price increase for groceries the year ending February 28th of 2021, with a 0.8% increase over the year ending February 29th of 2020. And that's from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Thank you. Sorry for interrupting, but let's go back here a minute. The increase was 8.6%, 228 of 21 to 228 of 22. No wonder people are saying, oh my gosh, these prices are crazy.
It's painful.
Yes, at the grocery store. All I wanted there to do was to buy a cooked chicken, and what did I, you know, I'm so shocked how much that thing was, or whatever.
There's been a few times when I'm checking out, and they ring something up, and I look at the screen, and I'm like, wait, what?
Wait, what?
And then I say, I can live without that.
Yeah.
I mean.
So people are going to start making those decisions.
Yeah, I'm making different decisions sometimes, you know, because you get what you normally get, and then you check out, you're like, wait, what am I bringing home? It's like a Seinfeld show. All right.
Yeah. Wait, what?
And then. 55% of 1,009 American adults surveyed in September of 2021 do not pay the full amount of their credit card debt each month. So 55% of those surveyed do not pay the full amount. And that's from Go Banking Rates.
I'm surprised 45% do, if we make that assumption, right? Mm-hmm. If 55 don't, 45 do.
That surprises you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Expensive money. Yeah.
45% pay their whole credit card every month.
Yep. In the month following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil rose by 21%, from $92.81 a barrel February 24th of 22 to $112.34 a barrel of March 24th of 2022. And that's from NYMEX. Ukraine's population is 43.3 million people. California's population...
Any guesses?
...is...
I saw it. I can't guess.
You saw it. Yeah. You can't cheat.
You want John to guess?
John, what do you think?
California's population, John, what do you think?
Oh, man, you're putting me on the spot. I have no... I'm complete guess. No idea. 95. I don't know.
95 million.
Ain't wrong.
One third
it's
of it. Nope.
38.9 million.
No. 39 million. Okay.
Worldometer is the source for that.
So it's Ukraine's just slightly larger than California.
Right.
Population.
Isn't that crazy when you think of it that way?
I was surprised still, honestly, that there are that many people in the Ukraine. In Ukraine, I should say.
I thought you were going to say that many people still in California. Considering the cost.
Yeah, they both have that in common. They have a lot of people leaving their California.
Speaking of moving, one voluntarily, the other not so much, right?
There's the Shea stats.
All right. Very good. So, John, thanks again for coming on in the midst of tax season.
Boy. Busy, good to get out every once in a while.
So. Now, in terms of CPAs, there is a lot going on in terms of their busyness, rather. You had made mention of that it's going to be very difficult if you don't already have a CPA to get one who can actually handle your tax return this year, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure right now. I mean, I would dare say if you're planning on going in an ACPA right now, it's almost going to be an automatic extension. We've been on automatic extension for any new clients pretty much all year long, and many other CPAs are as well around there. A big part of that is because many individuals and Americans have moved past COVID and the stimulus payments, because that's done and long gone, but as I joke with when I talk to people, I don't get to move forward into 2022 until October of this year. So my this year is 21. I'm still talking 21. And so we're still dealing with all of these items. So every return that we open still has that stimulus payment that you got back in January of 2021. So it seems like so long ago, but it takes every return takes a little bit more. So the PPP loans, the stimulus payments, the advance payments on credits, the just every single little thing, it infiltrated every farms and doctor's practices and everything. They all got different forms and different stimulus. And so it's just taking longer for everybody. So
that's making a difference as well. It's not just as though you might have more people asking for advice. You're spending a lot more time in some cases on these returns. We think, well, maybe isn't this a simple situation? Well, it was until this went on. The stimulus payments right?
And I think it's the case. Many business owners are dealing with this, or individuals are dealing with this, where it just takes longer, complications, teachers, others, that you have to work through different things. And it's no difference for accountants. So everything we open up or deal with is just a little bit more complicated because, all of these stimulus payments went through on a very short time frame that they made the decision, boom, let's do it. And they didn't think about the ramifications. Well, now that the dust has settled, the accountants are coming in and the attorneys and others are coming through. And well, what about this ramification of this ripple effect or that ripple effect or that ripple effect? You got to deal with the third ripple effect after something that happened, because it's in the details. That's where, as an accountant, that's where you're doing is you're thinking about the, I had one the other day that it was a basis limitation due to passive losses within allocation for a particular credit that came through. Well, that's three levels deep of limitations that happened, that the software doesn't plan for it, the accountant or the individual didn't even think about it, and so it's one of these items that you got to catch because that's there, but it just takes more time and more involved. So,
all right. So you really do need to spend, if you find yourself in this kind of a situation, my thinking is you may well want to file an extension for 21 if you're that far behind with all of your information. Would that be something you would recommend generally?
They're talking about red flags. A lot of people assume that an extension is a red flag. Maybe on the idea that, the only reason you'd have an extension is because I don't have all my information together. My observation, extensions are not red flags. What is a red flag is not paying the bill. So when you file an extension, all you're doing is you're saying, hey, I need more time to get everything together. The IRS would rather have a more accurate return than a hastily done one. So they don't mind giving extensions, but an extension doesn't mean you can extend the payment time. It just means you can extend the filing time. And so if you owe $8,000 with your return, by doing an extension, you don't get to push that forward. You still owe the $8,000, but you can extend the time to do the return.
So you still have to have a pretty good idea. Let me interrupt here. Pretty good idea what you owe, even if you're going to file an extension, so you can stay up with the tax that is owed. You've got to file the tax, or pay the tax, rather, even though you're not filing the official return.
Right. Correct.
All right. Very good.
Hey, John.
And one other thing go ahead, yeah.
I was going to ask, what's your understanding of the IRS staffing right now? Are they pretty understaffed, or what do you know, if anything, about that?
Well, they were horribly understaffed coming into this. And, you talk to any banker as all these funds were going out, and they would tell you they were understaffed because they weren't ready for any of this to happen. The legislation used the Treasury or the IRS to fund all these dollars. And so it instantly went through an already backlog system, and all of these new laws, all these new things, all the new responses had to be funneled through this. And so there is a horrible backlog. Like I said, they're still dealing with 2019 items. They're just starting to catch up into 2020 items. So there's a big backlog. Now, I know they've made they've now passed and they are now hiring people, but they're not any different than any other business out there that can't find workers. IRS has now said, well, great, we've got the funding now to do this, but we can't find workers either. And so it takes time to, once they find them, to train and work their way through. So I think it's going to get better, but it's still going to be a while. So.
Okay. Great.
Thanks for that.
Do we need to take a break here, Ron, or what are we, doing? Well, okay, another question. Fewer than 1 million Americans get audited each year. Actually, a statement from this article from the Wall Street Journal. This is where we got the 10 audit are red flags. But individuals who don't file their taxes or underreport their income are top of the list. That seems obvious. Someone that doesn't file their taxes, is that year after year? What do you think they're speaking of here, John?
Yeah, so a couple things within that, I guess, is there are individuals that don't need to file a tax return. So many retirees that are just on Social Security. So Social Security in itself is not taxable. So if all you're receiving is Social Security, you don't necessarily need to file a tax return. So not filing the return is not the red flag. What the red flag is having an income level that would show that you should have a return, but don't. That's the red flag. Most specifically, what oftentimes happens is, so the IRS is doing a return for you behind the scenes, right? That's the whole point of 1099s and W-2s and all that. They have information. So if they're not giving you a letter, it's generally because they've concluded it's in their favor and not yours. But what happens then is, let's say you go 2 or 3 years and you don't file a return because you're dealing all in cash or something along those lines. And then you go to file one for maybe you need a bank loan or something like that. So you skip 2 years and now you file one all of a sudden. By putting that line in the sand, you've moved it from oops to intentional defraud. Mm. And that's the red flag that happens, because then what they're going to do is they're going to go back and say, well, you told me that you didn't need to file a return for these last 2 years, but based on the information now, you do. That's where they hit you with hard penalties and interest. And so when it comes to audit, it's a good thing to understand, too, that the IRS, that they do cost-benefit analysis, too. And so auditing someone that they're not going to, auditing someone that makes, let's say, $50,000, and if they spend a week looking at your information, is going to change by $1,000, that's a losing game, right? They paid labor to get that dollar, so they're not going to do that. However, they're going to look at ones that didn't file the return, because, bam, they get the income, plus they're going to get the penalties and interest that come along with it. So it's a profitable endeavor for them to do that.
All right.
Same for the ones over, you know, same for, they'll typically say anyone over $1 million is a good item too. And again, that is because the chance of changing a swing of 1%, well, 1% on a tax bill for $1 million versus 1% on a tax bill for $50,000 is a big difference. They're going to look at there.
All right.
An interesting thing that has changed here in the demographics is that they've now highlighted and said that they are going to start looking at those below $40,000. So now it's over $1 million and under $40,000. And why that is because of what we were talking about earlier in the show, those earned income credits, the child tax credits, that's as a percentage, that makes a big difference. So again, zero-sum game of looking at the dollar amount. If you've got four kids at $10,000 each, and I'm rounding there, that's a $40,000 refund. That could, if it's doubly done, so the spouse, you know, the one took it, the other took it, that's a big number. And again, that's an extreme example, but.
Yeah. All right. So. We've gotten most of the points covered already just for the back and forth. So let's take a break here, shall we, Ron?
You're listening to New Retirement Radio, brought to you by the team at Prout Financial Design.
Hello, I'm your host, Certified Financial Planner, Dennis Prout.
I'm Heidi Cartwright, Financial Advisor and RICP.
I'm Shea Pataja, and I'm here for the stats and laughs.
Investment advisory services offered through Capital Asset Advisory Services, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Genios Wealth Management Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Capital Asset Advisory Services. The topics discussed and the opinions given are for informational purposes only and are not intended as financial, tax, accounting, or legal advice, and are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their individual needs with an appropriate professional.
And welcome back to New Retirement Radio on WTCM with Prout Financial Design. Mr. Dennis Prout and Shea Pataja are in from Prout, and on the phone, John Sluice, CPA from InTrust in Traverse City. Welcome back.
All right, it's great to be here. Thank you, Ron, and the new intro with Heidi's name new and all that kind of good stuff, too. Yeah, Heidi Conrad showing up there, and Shea with some additional verbiage there. That was awesome. Love it. And we're going to be changing that up through the weeks, too.
We'll see what that holds. We'll see. You know, so I got to have some surprises in retirement planning.
That's right.
It's going to be the radio show.
Steve, he's great. We appreciate him lots. All right. Number seven, John, is rental income.
Yep. Oh, boy.
Many people new to the rental business don't realize that all rental income is generally considered passive income. Passive income. not active. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so there's lots of different types of treatments, and I was alluding to it earlier in the talking about limitations between passive loss and active, and a lot of people assume all the only tax that they're paying is income tax, but there's different types of taxes. There's self-employment tax, there's net investment tax. So there's all different types of taxes within your tax return, and that's what they're getting to, is rental activity is treated differently often compared to what's called active income. So if you're working for an employer and your job, that's active, where rental is passive, usually. So I want to put a little asterisk here and say, if you own a bed and breakfast, well, that flips it back into active, because a bed and breakfast, you're providing a service as compared to maybe just providing a room, which is rental. And so the caveat there, and what makes this a red flag, is it's more complicated than people think it is. Like, oh, well, I'm just renting a room out. Well, no, there's lots of different nuances. Are you providing towels? If you're providing towels or a service, maybe you're going to shuttle them back and forth in a kayak. Well, is that pushing you over from a passive renter to an active innkeeper? So there's those types of accounting for it that comes along with it. So it gets into whether you're a roommate or whether it's just a full rental. There's the vacation rule. So the red flag there is it's just the sheer volume increase that has happened on split type of accounting. So the Airbnb and the VRBO, where it's a primary residence usually, but a little bit here. It's unusual for the IRS. The IRS likes black and white, clear cut. Well, I'm buying this for an investment. Well, of course, that's how we treat it. This whole mixed use is more difficult for the IRS.
So if you want to build a 500 square foot small place in the back, next to your lot, let's say, behind your house somewhere, because you want to rent it out in the summertime, you know, you want to be very aware of the tax implications of having done that. Is that a bed and breakfast, or is that a passive rental income situation?
Mm-hmm. And then even further with that, we've actually seen an increase in, say, ride share. So you're going to rent out your car, let's say, or you're renting out other what's called personal property. So when we talk about houses, that's real property that has one tax treatment versus personal property, which would be your car or some of the other rentals, like you're renting out kayaks or you're renting out different things.
What about my riding lawnmower?
If you rent out your riding lawnmower. Campers up here in northern Michigan is a common one. So you're renting out your camper. That has
people are renting their campers.
Yes, they are.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
Heard this.
Now, there's a website for
you might
that.
As well, right? So if you buy it and you only use it for 3 weekends, but you could utilize it for the rest of the time. And you can go set them up for people, because people not only don't have hitches. So it's become very yeah. common, actually. It's a great use.
I just sold mine. I got tired of cranking the pop-up.
Is there an advantage, John, to passive versus active income? Like if you're renting your property out and that would be passive income, but if you go give them a few candy bars, you're feeding them, does that become active income? Is there a benefit?
It could. So when you're talking to a tax accountant, we can never give a straight yes or no answer.
Yeah.
This is going to be one of those another examples. Generally speaking, passive is preferred over active because it's not as taxable. It has a more tax favorable treatment.
Okay.
So you're not paying self-employment taxes on another. Now, I say generally, because there's also limits that come along with that. So if it's a passive investment, you cannot, if you have too much of income, it gets limited and you can't drive it into a loss, let's say, whereas if it's active, you can.
Well, let's interrupt there. So if there is a passive loss, you can't use that against your W-2 income. That's what
correct.
You're saying,
if
correct?
If you have certain incomes. Now, again, there are different phases in of that. So if you're below a certain threshold, then you can use a little bit of it. And then if you're above a threshold, you can't use any of it. And then even further, if you have two different rental properties, the losses on one rental property can't offset the gains on another rental property, generally.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now,
again,
I'm going to...
The red flag comes with this is you note the number of times I said generally, except for, yeah, asterisk, yes, and otherwise. There's the red flag when it comes with this one.
So seek counsel. If you're going to look at a rental like this, make certain that you're getting the ins and outs, positives and negatives of doing such a thing from the tax standpoint as well. Of course, right? Makes sense?
Yep.
Good, John. Now, I want to insert a question that's not in the material right here, just because you were gracious enough to send us the Walters Kluwer information, and I had seen this article 2 days ago. They're considering... Our lawmakers are considering extending the age at which one would have to take an RMD to age 75, by 2035. Do you think that has much chance of passing?
Well, I'm going to answer that by telling what I tell my clients is you're asking an accountant to look forward. And my crystal ball is really cracked and hazy.
Yeah.
Because as an accountant, I look backwards. But with that said, I actually think that there is a chance on this because they've paired this back, this what you call secure 2.0. They've paired it back pretty consistent and not attached it to other things, I guess. So if you look at it, the House passed it, and that was in that article we sent, was
yes.
They passed it 414-5. So that's a good indicator that something of that nature is going to pass. I think generally people want it. People like the idea of saving for it. They've stuck that in. That's really the only one that's a revenue opposite for the IRS in that whole package. So most of the other ones are going to help the IRS, but also help saving as well. Mm. But that one there is, they're throwing it in there. So of all of them, I could see that one getting pulled. But it could stick through. So.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. And Ed Slott came in with a quote on that too. And he said he wasn't so sure it was a good thing because it's simply delaying what is going to happen anyway. And if taxes are higher, that may not be a good thing. So the required minimum distributions may indeed make more sense, even though they're not required, to still take those and pay the tax on those, especially if tax rates remain as low as they are currently.
You know,
are we close to a break
that,
here, Ron?
Part of what you're seeing there is that we think of, okay, that's better for the employees because the individuals, because retirees, because they can wait.
Yeah.
The IRS is going to outlive all of us, right? They're playing the long game.
Right.
You mentioned that, okay, the chances are that tax rates are going to go up. So by delaying it, they're playing the long game and saying, hey, we have a chance of getting it more at the higher tax bracket. So
Yes. It's
not necessarily a good thing.
Right.
All right. Well, we have to wrap up here. So John Slew, special guest today, CPA from Intrust. John, thanks again for your time and expertise.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it, John.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find us online at proutfinancialdesign.com. That's P-R-O-U-T, financialdesign.com. Also, you'll be able to find us on iTunes and SoundCloud.